You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Parish Council, the official podcast of the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's a buffalo soldier, a dreadlock master. He is Terence de Combe. Hello.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. Hey. How are you today?
Oh, I'm okay. You know, I still have trace elements of this virus that I had on the podcast last week. It has a long tail, I believe, is the parlance. Yeah.
Yes, we can hear it in your tones.
Yeah, it's still with me. It's still with me. I'm sure
the listeners join with me in sending our every sympathy at this difficult time for your nasal passages.
That's very kind. I don't feel ill anymore, which is a blessing. But I'm still very throaty and nasally, and which gives me a perfect excuse to just sort of generally whinge on an hourly basis to whoever's in front of me that I'm not well.
Well, do bring that to the podcast. We'll all be overjoyed.
I thought I already had.
Now, in a moment, I want to ask you and indeed chat with you about the whole notion of breakfast. But before that, it's time for listener reaction, because I want to just mention a couple of listeners that have been in touch with us this week.
Oh, yeah, this is like the letters page in the NME, isn't it?
It's exactly so, yes. First of all, Oliver Jones got in touch with us this week, and he, amongst various other pieces of communication, which were very welcome, he mentions that he asks if we can narrow the stereo in our conversation, because he feels there's a ping-pong effect. You're over there.
Mm-hmm.
There you are, you see?
Yeah, hello, I'm over here, yes.
And he finds that rather wearing. Okay. But before, which I think many people might find the whole podcast very wearing. Before we...
Unless it was actually, only that he was complaining about.
Well, exactly. It could have been far worse. But before we ask anybody to try and fix that, I just wanted to make sure that we do give other listeners a fair chance to say either, no, leave it alone, it's perfectly fine with him over there and you over there, or... Hats off to Oliver. Why didn't you all do this earlier and stop the ping pong thing?
This is the Scottish independence referendum writ large, isn't it?
It really is. it's our own micro version of the same.
To stereo and or not to stereo.
Absolutely. So be very interesting to
you. You stand in the Jim Steinman camp or the Phil Spector camp?
Yes, exactly. Do you want the wall of sound?
Yes.
Or do you want the sort of
panoramic choirs? Yes. Yeah.
I'll be interested to see if anybody has any firm views on that, because we can react to that, of course. And one will just please your heart. I wasn't going to mention this one because I thought, I've got away with this since Christmas.
Oh, right.
But I feel I have to tell you that Andy Cochran has been in touch, and he wants to see the return of the virtual.
Oh, brilliant.
And I thought, no, I'll pretend I didn't see that tweet.
Oh,
but...
well, that was great. Oh, good. Well, okay, let's bring it back next week then.
Oh, God. Andy Cochran, now look what you've done.
I shall go into the vicarage garage and get all the equipment out that required for the virtual iPod.
If anybody doesn't want to hear it, please join with me in saying, no, don't bring that feature back. We hated it.
God bless you for that, Mr. Cochran, was
Andy,
it?
Andy Cochran.
Thank you, Andy. Yes, we'll
no, we I've gone right off the bloke.
We should really do that without hesitation. Fantastic.
I knew I shouldn't have mentioned it. Now, Magnus Shaw, have you had breakfast this morning?
Yes, I have. Just before we went, inverted commas, on air, I had a cinnamon and raisin bagel with Lurpak butter, lightly toasted.
How delightful.
Oh, and
it
a cup of tea, of course.
And a cup of
and
tea.
And a cigarette.
Okay, so I'm afraid you can't compete with the breakfast I'm about to put before you.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yes, but in theory only. You may be delighted.
I was rather hoping that a white-gloved footman might be about to come through the door and present me with a breakfast. But
we shall see if you feel that way when I've described this breakfast to you, because have you any intentions at all today or tomorrow, as you've already had breakfast, of going to Great Yarmouth in Norfolk?
Well, it crossed my mind briefly at about 6 o'clock this morning, and I balanced it up with sitting on my bony bum and watching movies and reading the paper, and the latter one. So,
Oh, that's great Yarmouth's loss. Well, this started off with a mention of this on Five Live, BBC Five Live this morning, and okay. I've now gone on and done some research myself about this item. And
oh, eager beaver.
Oh, I've been up since dawn preparing
since,
this.
Since dawn left.
Yes, indeed. In Jester's Diner in Great Yarmouth, you can actually have from the menu the kids' breakfast.
Oh, can you, yeah?
Yeah, okay. But it's called the kids' breakfast, not because it's suitable for children, but because it actually has the weight of a small child. And that's why it's been called the kids' breakfast.
It's normally like four chicken nuggets and some oven chips, isn't it?
Absolutely. No, this weighs the same as a small child.
Amazing.
4.08 kilograms. The local heart care cardiac support group has said finishing the meal would absolutely, quote, ruin your heart.
So, in one meal.
One meal. Now, this is the deal. It's called the Jester's Challenge, and it's this cafe, Jester's Cafe, on the Morton Pito Road in Yarmouth. Mm-hmm. Now, you're invited to eat this breakfast in 60 minutes, with no additional help.
Right.
And if you get through it, you get it free of charge.
Oh, yeah, this is an American concept, isn't it?
They do it with
steaks, don't they? Yeah. Yeah,
they do. Now, the price if you fail to eat the whole thing in 60 minutes is £15. So that's not too bad.
Right.
They actually have to serve it on a plate that covers 2.5 square feet.
Good grief, where do you get a plate like that from? Not a plate, that's a hubcap.
Yes, it's a dustbin lid. Your white-gloved waiter coming in with a dustbin lid. The owner, Mr. Smith, says... Yes, in case of any legal action. We kept getting hassled that our fat boy breakfast wasn't big enough. So we decided we'd go one stage further and take it to the ultimate. So...
hassled, you know, when on his way home, there were groups of hungry-looking punters.
Gourmets coming
jostling
up
him in the streets, saying, hey, what's the deal with this fat boy breakfast, man? You need to get a crusher brief here.
Now, from the National Obesity Forum, Professor David Haslam lets us know that the calories in the meal, which I will reveal to you in a moment, amount to about 6,000, which is up to 3 days' food intake for an average person. And he's trying to get the diner to take it off the market. So now I'm going to present the menu to you. This is you have to eat this in 60 minutes. And my question to you is, could you do it?
Okay.
This is the kids' breakfast at Jester's Cafe in Great Yarmouth. Okay. 12 rashers of bacon.
12, right.
12 rashers of bacon. 12 sausages.
That's two packs of sausages, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. 6 eggs.
Yes, okay.
4 black pudding slices.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's done it for me anyway. Yeah.
4 slices of bread and butter.
Oh, only 4?
Oh, wait a minute. That's not the end of your bread intake.
Oh, okay, right.
4 slices of toast.
Oh.
And yet more bread on top. 4 slices of fried bread.
Yeah, okay.
2 hash browns.
Only 2?
8 egg, cheese and potato omelette.
8 omelettes?
8 eggs. With cheese and potato, the omelette made with 8 eggs.
Each one?
No, an omelette. You can make an omelette with one egg, two eggs, three eggs. This is made with 8 eggs.
Right, okay, yes.
An omelette made with 8 eggs to create it, and then cheese and potato bunged in.
Right, nice.
Sauté potatoes.
Right, leftover
mushrooms.
From the omelette. Mushrooms, yes. Does it say a quantity?
It doesn't say a quantity, no. I
suspect a field of
mushrooms. Yes, it's probably measured in handfuls rather than spoonfuls. Baked beans and tomatoes. Could you get through that in your 60 minutes, or would you have to cough up the £15 and then probably cough up your heart as well?
I couldn't, because when it came to the black pudding, that would do it. If there was like one slice of black pudding, that would prevent me from going further, I think, really.
Yeah, me too. There's two things that I would have to avoid, swerve there. The black pudding puts me off just by the nature of what it is.
Yes, indeed.
And I have a real aversion to cheese. So the the thing that the ingredient that confused you so greatly, the 8-egg cheese and potato omelette would be out of the question for me.
Oh, no, the cheese wouldn't be a problem. I mean, what I think I'd be tempted to do is order it and get some mates in.
It really does say you cannot have any help.
No help.
No, I don't think I can do that, no. And anybody who does do it would be doing it in order to be splashed on the front of the Yarmouth Gazette, wouldn't they?
I think
that's probably at the heart of it, really. It's the publicity angle.
Yeah, for the cafe and for anybody who eats it, no doubt about it. There's a there's a really wonderful curry establishment on the Curry Mile in Bradford. And they offer the world's largest naan bread with your curry.
Ooh, I'd like that.
Yeah, there's no price for consuming it, unfortunately. But okay. They say, you know, do you want the naan bread? Well, when I went, you know, I ordered my curry and they said, do you want the naan bread? And I said yes. I hadn't noticed the plaques on the wall and the newspaper clippings about this being the home of the world's largest naan bread. I thought they were just offering me a naan bread. I said, oh, I'll have a naan bread. Yeah, it's bigger. Mm. It's bigger than the table.
Wow.
They have to bring a small table for it to sit on.
Oh, how fantastic. Mm. I would love that. I love naan bread and I love garlic bread in proper Italian restaurants. Mm. But when they make it from pizza base.
Oh, yes, I know the thing.
God, yeah. I love that. Yeah. Oh, my giddy aunt. Yeah. But rather like you, I think I will have to turn down the Jester's Challenge, the kids' breakfast, 4.08 kilograms in Great Yarmouth.
I like the witticism of calling it the kids' breakfast. I think there's irony in that. It just astonishes me that the chairman of the National Conference on Obesity, I was actually moved to issue a statement. I mean, he's just playing into the PR aspect of this, isn't he?
Of course. I mean, it's a fantastic publicity splash for the restaurant, isn't it? And I'm sure you're right. That's the purpose behind it. And they can't lose, can they? Because if somebody can come in and eat that, good luck to them, I would say. I think it's probably far harder than it sounds. You just read the ingredients and you think, okay. But I mean, if you just think of the first three things, 12 rashers of bacon, 12 sausages and 6 eggs.
Forbid you bringing a Doberman Pinscher or a Labrador with you, because that would solve it, wouldn't it? If you just kept slipping sausages down under the table, that would get you through it.
That would get you through it, but I don't think that quite meets the purposes of the challenge.
No. Oh, well, hats off to the Jester's Cafe for keeping coronarily challenged members of the community in stodgy, greasy food. Yeah, good for them.
Yeah. There's one lady that goes further than the other doctor fellow, Ellie Hambling from the Heart Care Cardiac Support Group from some university hospital, said the meal contains such severe health risks that someone eating it who had a heart condition could die in the cafe. So Miss Hambling says it would absolutely ruin your heart, and it's a no-goer, I'm afraid, she says.
Right, okay, yes. Reeled in. I get this impression of various health experts being reeled in by the cafe to make these statements. Yes,
absolutely.
The most sensible thing they could have said is, that sounds perfectly okay to me. Then they wouldn't have been able to use the comment, would they? So.
Now, leading into the next item, though, I have to tell you that, unfortunately, very negatively, the Jester's Diner actually spelled kids' breakfast KIDZ Z for
American.
Oh, they've
let themselves down very badly.
They've let themselves badly down there, kids' breakfast with a Z or Z, which I think takes us on to something that you want to bring to our attention, Magnus Shaw.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I just have a mortal fear that we, here in 2012, have reached the point where we've abandoned all semblance of care over the priority of good spelling. Now, this has been going on for a long time, hasn't it? And I've come across for years, instances of very intelligent and worldly people who are quite good at their job with absolutely no capacity to spell whatsoever. And I think it stems from a time in education when there was some sort of liberalization of spelling whereby, you know, children were told, oh, it doesn't matter if you spell it right as long as you do your homework, you know. But when it comes to people who have taken up positions in the creative writing industries, then I think if you then still can't spell, then you've sort of negated your purpose, you've negated your job, haven't you? Two things cropped up for me this week. One was in the Metro newspaper on the television page, and I think this would have been Tuesday. In the paper, there was a large ad, bottom left, which actually happened to be for electronic cigarettes. And it was the art direction wasn't terrific, but you can forgive that. That's entirely up to them. But the headline was Break the Habit. And the word habit had two T's on the end.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Now, if this ad had been through an advertising agency, then the copywriter in the agency, you know, should have been summarily dismissed. If it hadn't been through an advertising agency, at least the advertising department at Metro should have looked at the artwork and flagged up to the client that they had misspelled their headline. Plus, I did check this out, that size of advert in that position in the paper is knocking on the door of £5,000. I had no way of telling whether it'd only run regionally or nationally, but that's say a mean of £5,000. If you were about to invest £5,000 in an advertisement, would you not just check, you know, every aspect of that advertisement that you've got it quite right, particularly the headline? Or,
well, absolutely.
Does nobody care? Does it not matter in the slightest? So that was one instance. I thought, well, okay, you know, sloppy, very sloppy indeed. And if it's been through an advertising agency, you know, sacking offence in my book. But I just about calmed down and soothed my fevered brow over this outrage when yesterday, as part of a project I'm working on, I was asked to embed a BBC video from BBC local news in your neck of the woods, actually.
Okay.
So is that BBC South is your local?
Yes, yeah, that is my local station.
Right. There you go. So it's your local station. And I was asked to embed a video into a website from YouTube. Now, when somebody posts a video to YouTube these days, you're invited to write a description of what the video is. So I was embedding this video and I noticed in the three-sentence description, which had obviously been written by somebody at BBC South, there were no fewer than three literal and spelling errors. Children in Need had been written with a lowercase c but an uppercase n. Mm,
okay.
And it was also the incorrect usage of there.
that's incredibly common. Yeah.
And incorrect usage of let me think, what was it? It was an incorrect usage of I think it was two, actually. I think it was two.
OTOO for TO or TW.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this had been written. Yeah. I mean, it was only flipping 2.5 sentences. and presumably, somebody, whether it was a journalist or not, at the BBC had been tasked with posting this video and writing the description to it. So, if you're in the communication business and you can't use the correct spelling or correct grammar, then do you have any business being there, or does it really no longer matter?
Well, some people would say, and I don't agree with them, I'll say right at the start, that it doesn't matter. And I think there is an increasing growth in that point of view because so much of the written work I see just day to day underlines that it almost seems to be a forgotten art. I've mentioned before, I cannot understand to this day how children of the current generations and last generation certainly, go through at least 10 years through the school system and are unable at age 16 or 17 to be able to spell the most straightforward day-to-day words. I just don't understand. I have asked this question of many people. What do they actually do all day? Because, as you say, they come out of school being unable to spell the most basic words. Now, quite recently, the Times Higher Education magazine reacted to this. And again, we had a Mr. Smith earlier. Now we've got a Dr. Smith. Dr. Ken Smith was writing in the Times Higher Education magazine as a senior lecturer. And he said that he's got so fed up with teaching graduates, I should say, students, aiming to graduate at his university. He's got so fed up with correcting their atrocious spelling that he's more or less just given it up and accepted that these variations are just going to move into our general usage. Now, there is something to that, because if you look at documents from post-medieval times through Tudor, through Regency, through Victorian, words do get spelt differently just as society grows. And actually, on a more personal level, there's no more outstanding example for me, as I say, on a very personal level, because my surname has so many variations of spelling, because it's got an ancient name, and nobody used to write it down in sort of the Dark Ages, and we went through the sort of Norman times and everything, and so people then just wrote down how they thought something.
Why you're often called Dickwad on Twitter?
Oh, very good. But you know, people, words only got written down for the first time in the late Middle Ages, when people began people had to pay tax. Frankly, that was the where more or less common writing, obviously people wrote before then, but writing became common in that period, because they would then say Mr. Dacom, or more likely, of course, Lord Dacom, must pay.
As in, please find enclosed 9/10 of my corn from the last harvest, Lord Dacom.
Exactly so, Magnus Shaw. You would be paying me in corn or whatever. But that's how words started getting written down. Well, there was nobody to say how it should be done. So and then words evolved. So there actually is an argument that would stand some sort of test that says it's not the end of the world if somebody spells February February without the middle R.
But I think that argument falls down, because the reason there were all those variations in spelling in those eras that you speak about is that because there was mass illiteracy, and those who could write at all were onto something. So the spelling was neither here nor there. And in much the same way as, a lot of law was not formalised in some of those eras, we progress and we settle on things and agree on things, and that is a mark of progress. So when we agree on spellings, that suggests that we've agreed on a standardised form of communication. That is progress. So to then start to revert back to random spelling is a sign of regress. So I don't think that's any positive argument whatsoever, that once upon a time it wasn't very standardized, therefore why should we be standardized now? Because you could apply that to like sanitation, couldn't you?
Well, being let me be an advocate for the devil here for one brief moment. Does it matter so long as we are understood? The inclusion of a D or an R or an E here or there does it matter if you and I or anybody else could understand the point that we're trying to make?
Well, it does, because it means at some point you are less likely to understand, and therefore you're corrupting the fine art of communication. That if all bets are off, at some point or other, it will be harder to understand what somebody is writing, and that can't possibly be a good thing. Plus, you know, there's a discipline to good communication, and part of that discipline is to adhere to the standardized set of rules. And so if you want to do something well, then you learn the rules inside out, like a sport or anything else. You know, if you want to be very adept and impressive at chess, then you spend a lot of time establishing what's, you know, is legitimate on the board, what isn't, and how you can then use those rules coupled with your skill to achieve a certain outcome. The same applies to, to being adept at written communication, that you learn the rules and then you learn to deploy them in an exceptionally good way. If we abandon the rules, then that discipline breaks down and it's all the more difficult to be exceptional at it.
I think one of the problems is that we make the rules and then we make exceptions for those rules. And I well remember at my prep school, Miss Waters, I would have been probably 5 or 6, drumming into the class, I before E, except after C.
Yes, which is, well, that's a nonsense, isn't it? Yes.
But it's a rule that I don't know whether they still say it in schools, but certainly it's in common parlance that if you're learning to spell, it's always I before E, except after C.
Yeah, and it's a rule to which there are more exceptions than adherences.
Well,
so
this is my point.
That is daft.
This is my point. One teaches a certain law, if you like, a code, a rule, a guide to follow, and then one has to immediately follow that by saying, but there's a caveat to all of this, young people,
yes,
because if you're writing the word foreign,
yes,
it's not I before E except after C, it's E before I.
Just because sometimes rules are taught poorly, that is no reason to say, therefore, we should not have any rules because people don't teach them very well. You know,
Is it that we've had a change in society, perhaps in the last 20, 30 years, where there's been a huge influx of can't-be-bothered-itis?
Well, yes, and, quite so, yes, yes.
And so rather than learn those individual quirks, like, neighbour has the E before the I, and as you mentioned earlier, there for he's
yes,
over
I've actually
there.
I just brought up the video now. That it wasn't a misuse of two and two. It was a misuse of whose and whose.
Oh,
yeah,
that puts it
here. Yeah, they've written young people whose parents. WHO'S.
Yeah. Oh, the old apostrophe cropping in, particularly as well for plurals. I blame this on, of course, sloppiness, but it's people's over reliance on spell check computers on PCs in Word, because the computer program hasn't got sufficient width of understanding to be able to differentiate. And so I saw a document earlier this week from quite a high level source that kept referring to CVs, curriculum vitae's, in the plural, CVs. But every time CVs was written, it had an apostrophe between the V and the S.
Yeah.
And, you know, this has gone out to a huge, wide audience. It's an official document.
You think Nick Clegg would know better, wouldn't you?
You would, but I imagine that it was an intern that did it for him. But it's more to the point that someone had thought, oh, well, I've whacked that through spell check, and it's come up saying the spelling and grammar is fine. Because you could, if you were saying that something belonged to a CV, you could say
CV's inherent flaws, you could say.
Exactly.
Could, that's not the pluralization.
But a word spell check can't make that differentiation. And that's, of course, where I'm now lining up by your side and saying it is important, because ultimately, only a human can make that decision about whether something is correct or not. And this over-reliance on spell check is leading to disasters.
And there is a noble profession of humans who are very good at knowing how written language is deployed. And, you know, people earn their living, not least of all, to one extent or another, you and I in our living, having a modicum of knowledge about how to write well within the strictures of the language. And if we just say it no longer matters, then we're sort of cocking a snoot to the people who've taken the time and trouble to get good at it and earn a living from it. But there's no philosophy behind, actually, we should abandon this discipline around spelling. It's not a philosophical decision. It's the path of least resistance. It's, as you say, can't be botheredness. If something requires extra efforts to do it well, then, that effort is increasingly not made, you know, and this is the path of least resistance. If I can write in a way using spelling that I've just made up, that is easier. Therefore, I will take that path. You know,
if you send a text message, do you succumb to writing U, the letter U for you?
No, God, no. When I send text messages, they are punctuated and written out in full.
Me too. We're old men, Magnus. We're out of step.
Yes. My children have long mocked me since the rise of SMS. Mm-hmm. My children have not mocked me, but pointed out to their friends that, my dad, when he texts me, it has full stops and apostrophes and commas and semicolons and such like in it. They think that's really sort of quaint, you know. They don't disparage me for it, but they think it's quaint, you know. Every fibre of my being would prevent me from doing anything else, because I went to a very traditional school where, spelling mistakes in an essay would have an enormous red ring round them, you know. Demand for this to be put right forthwith, you know, and I can remember if you made a spelling mistake in a piece of homework at school, at the end, when it was given back to you by the teacher would have instructed you by way of a note to write the correct spelling 20 times, wouldn't they? You remember that?
Yes, I do recall it's like that. I don't think we used to have to write it 20 times. I think 3 times.
Oh, whatever, but it was. You've misspelled through. Here, you've used the wrong use of through. Write it down here. Write it down at the end of this essay correctly. At the time, one thought that was draconian. But looking back, I think, I would quite happily march through the world making people write things down correctly, you know, till I got arrested for being a madman, you know. It absolutely does matter because... We're not, if we take that regressive path, we're not doing it because a whole new philosophy has sprung up around the written word. It would be because we can no longer be bothered. And that's not going to be good.
No, I line up shoulder to shoulder with you there. Now, talking of sending messages and so on, I actually sent you a tweet earlier in the week to say, are you going to watch Coppers? Yeah. On Channel 4 on Monday, and delightfully, I think you did watch it.
Yeah, I've watched all the last season, and I'm watching this season as well, particularly watching this season with enthusiasm, because it's all set in my hometown of Nottingham.
It is indeed. excuse me. And I must say, I didn't watch the first season, but I picked up on Coppers through Twitter and people saying, you know, this is extraordinary. Mm. And I've watched this season. I think it was episode 3 on Monday. Mm. And I think I tweeted just before it started, I've got a feeling this is going to be terribly depressing. And so it turned out.
Yeah, it kind of is. But, it's... It's depressing because it's truthful and it's compelling for the selfsame reason.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get an adrenaline rush running round in fast cars, said one of the policemen on Monday night, but also then let us know that he felt society has gone by the wayside. I thought one of the most depressing, I think depressing is going to be a word I'm going to use a lot as we talk about this, but one of the most disheartening parts of it was that they reported the policeman in this, which, as you say, is based in the in the Midlands, around the Nottingham area. They were with some policemen in Worksop, which I imagine is quite nearby.
Yeah, between Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire, yes, on the border there, yeah.
And there were some parts that just really horrified me. There was a PCSO, which is one of those community support officers, Kendra Drake, up saying that a admittedly attractive, pretty woman, said that, you know, she walks down the street and these yobs are calling her a MILF, which I don't want us to actually explore any further. But, you know, how awful that any woman should have to walk down the street having that yelled at her, and let alone a policeman. Mm. But they seemed, these policemen that we saw on Monday, they seemed to spend almost all of their time, or certainly much of their time, on what is these days called antisocial behaviour. Mm. And I was particularly, distressed at this Debbie, whose 14-year-old son Jordan was beating up his mother, Debbie. But there was no father there, so PC Steve Porter seemed to be called in to be playing the role of the parent. He went out looking for the child in his car, got him in the car, took him home, and then had to sort of mediate between the parent and the 14-year-old child. And the mother, Debbie, her first thought when this child, well, misbehaved is understating it, her first thought was, I'm going to call the police.
Mm. Mm.
And then we had the phone call that initiated it. There was a phone call. A man phoned in, said that his family was being kept awake by the rabbits next door.
Yes.
Which they then ended up with the seventh family officer. Again, it was poor PC Steve Porter going round to intervene in these warring neighbours who incidentally used to be friends. And they ended up refusing mediation. I mean, is this what life is like in the East Midlands area?
First, I should say it's a bit of a fallback to our last subject, because if we abandoned the rigours of good spelling, then this message could have been passed through that a family were having trouble with the rabbis next door. But in all seriousness,
yes.
Is this what life is like? Well, this is what life is like in not just in Worksop or Nottingham. This is what life is like on in many estates, in many towns across the country. I think what we saw on Coppers was probably the tamer end of what occurs sometimes in these places. If I could postulate and come to a conclusion as to why certain sections of certain towns and cities have descended to this sort of sub-civilized existence, then, you know, I would be chairing government bodies and looking to receive an OBE. I think a lot of this must surely stem from a powerlessness in all its forms. I think the lady whose son had assaulted her and she called the police was powerless to instruct, discipline or control her son, and felt powerless to act when he stepped way beyond acceptable boundaries, so he had to involve the police. Equally, the police felt powerless because various legislation restricts them from really acting in any meaningful way. That they also felt powerless that they would get any support from the courts if they spent the time and effort taking these miscreants in front of a court, that the court wouldn't support the police nor the victim, and you know, there would just be a long string of reprimands rather than any determined action. But also, I think the people committing the offences that we saw were also doing so out of a sense of powerlessness, whether they realised it or not, that they felt that they didn't have any meaningful contribution to make to society and to the world around them, that the world around them didn't wish to give them any influence or and when I say power, I don't mean power to you know, boss people about, but you know, self-power, self-empowerment, and the only way that they could assert their individuality and attain any kind of power was to inflict misery on other people, which then gave them a sort of perverted notion of power that they felt was lacking. You know, if they had worthwhile lives. And I think
not just on other people though, Magnus. Sometimes it was turned on themselves. Oh, yeah, and the misery that they were inflicting was on themselves. Because yes, we had that the druggie house, which was described as having an unearthly stench, yeah, by one of the policemen, with Kerry, where we kept hearing "Listen to me, Kerry" by one of the policemen, and her unique garden, which was clearly not designed by Alan Titchmarsh. I couldn't see a water feature out there. But countering that, somebody who was passing his problems on to other people was the man who got caught. He'd just paid £160 for heroin from his benefit, and when they brought him into the police station, he had this bag. And he was trying to explain away why in this bag he would have a hammer, a screwdriver, yes, a bungee cord, yes, a torch, a balaclava. That tended to be the giveaway. And a crowbar. Mm. He seemed to have some pride in the fact that he'd made the balaclava himself.
He did, yeah.
It was
yeah,
a homemade, a burglary kit. And he, well, I thought was very telling. He said, "Oh, I'm not using it. And I said, "Well, why do you keep it?" And there was one word that he used that I wanted to just us to pick up on. He said, "I have it if I need to go out grafting."
Oh, yes.
Now, to you and I, going out grafting would mean actually going out to work, yeah, I suspect, yeah, whether it's, you know, toiling the fields with a plough or copywriting or writing, you know, prose for the Rocking Vicar or whatever it, sure, is. That's going out grafting. Mm. But for him, going out grafting was taking out his homemade balaclava and his bungee cord and his crowbar. Mm.
Yeah.
And but the again, what you were just saying a moment ago, and I'm sorry I interrupted you, but this is what made me do it, was that you talked about people going round and round. Because despite this evidence of all those items I just read out there, he wasn't charged with going equipped for burglary, they said. He got done for the heroin, but he wasn't charged with going equipped for the burglary. Okay. And so you get these people who are arrested, go to court, back on the streets the same day, going round and round. Mm. And nobody exemplified that more than my last example, which was Danny Wilson, who had the ASBO that banned him from the town centre in Worksop.
That's right.
He still goes back into that town centre every day, growling at passers-by was the phrase. He'd lived in a skip. And
should you, but, you know.
No, and
they also said his friend had to run and pull him out of the skip on the day the skip company came to crush the contents.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, imagine what a lifestyle to be in such a situation. He'd had a stroke because he'd been injecting drugs directly into his neck.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I say, I still found a spark of humanity in his eyes when he'd sobered up. But of course, he was described as a lost cause. But I thought probably, again, part of your locality, which I'd be interested to know, he kept being called "My Duck" by PC Porter. You know, "Come on, my duck, you know that's not right." But it just seemed to me that the police, as they very clearly said, they're not the right medium to deal with Danny Wilson. I was just taken with one final quote. They said, "We've become the sponge for society."
I mean, what is quite obvious is that the people featured have all adopted these behaviours as a lifestyle. Now, we all need and have a lifestyle. We have a string of activities which takes us from one end of the week to the other, which, vary in their scope. But on the whole, you know, they frame our life. I guess the clue's in the name, a lifestyle. What these people have done is access a lifestyle which offers the path of least resistance. It doesn't demand anything of them that requires any discipline or motivation or ambition. Where we have failed these people as a society is to allow them to access that kind of lifestyle, and made it very easy for them. And it is, you know, human nature to search out the path of least resistance, and that is what they've done. They've opted for a lifestyle which is the least demanding. Unfortunately, that lifestyle is available to them with impunity. And so we can't really be surprised that people then go and opt for it. I'm not saying that they shouldn't face the consequences of their actions, but I think that is what brings about those actions, is that that kind of life is made available to them.
And in a smart piece of programming, Channel 4 followed coppers with party paramedics, where they turned the cameras southerly and focused on the town of Colchester in Essex in the summer. And we followed, as I say, coppers with this programme, where we saw the work of the SOS buses, which amazingly are now a growing feature in towns
yes,
and cities around.
We have one here where I live, yes, we do, on a Friday and Saturday night, yeah.
Saturday night. Paramedics and volunteers manned these buses to take the pressure off accident and emergency department. And in the episode that we saw on Monday, every incident appeared to be alcohol related, but the young people seemed to glory in the chaos, the minor violence and the vomit that came along with the gig. It was depressing to see the poorly educated inarticulateness of many of the participants. One young lady at the beginning said, "We're binge drinkers, we're English, that's what we do."
Yeah.
And the first participant that I was going to mention to you and see if you noticed it too was 19-year-old Chelsea, who fell and hurt her foot in a nightclub. And I felt that she was a character right out of John Betjeman. She was a sylph-like figure with a floaty dress. And she might have been a member of a tennis club three generations ago and be waiting for a young man to sweep her off her feet. She was a very floaty young lady, you know, who had this sort of old-fashioned look about her. But in 2012, she's a gobby teenager with a less-than-gallant boyfriend who went to McDonald's before joining Chelsea in the care of the SOS bus. Did you see Chelsea?
Yeah, I did. I saw the whole programme. I think there's something very different going on in this programme. And, you know, you quoted the girl as saying, "We're English, we binge drink, that's what we do." Shocking though that statement is, she couldn't have been more accurate. That is what we do. A recognised weekend leisure activity for a lot of people of a certain age span, and it's probably a bigger span than we imagine. It is the default choice for a weekend's japes is to drink your own body weight in alcohol, cause yourself distress and injury, and those around you, as well as wasting an inordinate amount of time and money within the NHS and the police service. We do that. There's no point really in us saying, "Oh, well, that's a ridiculous way to portray the English," or "It's an offensive way to portray the English," or indeed the British, because for a lot of people, that is what we do. It is something of a mystery as to why this has come about. As a nation, we've always had a very different relationship with alcohol from our continental neighbours. And certainly, certain parts of the Union have, you know, hard drinking has been very much a cultural focus. And that goes back many years. I think what has happened is this notion of the working man spending all week in a foundry at a coal face in a timber yard, and then at the weekend releasing his pent up frustrations and tiredness with beer, stretches back many, many decades. What I think that has now been seized upon by the leisure industry and exaggerated and amplified as really the only game in town for a night out. I'll compare and contrast with myself. I mean, like yourself, I don't drink alcohol at all. So I can look at this as an objective observer, for I'm never drunk. But when I was the age of people like Chelsea, I had an abiding drive to have nights out on a Friday and Saturday night. That's, exactly what I wanted to do with my weekend, is to go out on a Friday and Saturday night. But what I wanted to do was go to clubs and listen to the records that I liked to the point that it hurt, and dance to them. And also encounter members of the opposite sex. They were my two priorities. I couldn't afford to get drunk whilst doing that. Even if I could have afforded it, and I'm talking, if I bought one drink on a Saturday night, it meant that I had some excess cash, because usually I couldn't afford one drink. I could afford my entrance to a club and a packet of cigarettes. Even if I could have afforded to have got drunk, I wouldn't have done, because that would negate the possibility of A, dancing all night to great music, and B, executing my strategy to attach myself to a member of the opposite sex. I think if I was that age now, getting very, very drunk would have trumped all those, perhaps. And I think somehow this must have, the leisure industry has promoted this as really the only game in town, as I say, for a party night out. So the party night out for me meant something very different, and I'm only going back 25 years.
Yeah, I think you and I both, within a few years, we're sort of a generation apart from this, and I think that some of these young people I actually found quite likeable, but they were rendered incoherent and unlikeable through that absorption of alcohol. There's a couple of other examples that saddened me, really. That you had the squaddies arrived, and there was Remy, who was 24. He'd survived a tour of Afghanistan, but then someone tried to bite his nose off in Colchester, and that's how he ended up in medical treatment. We saw Molly and Rob, who went home in the SOS minibus as the sun rose, and Molly went off to be sick in the garden.
Yes.
And we had the closing shots of the program was the bus with its, by the way, advert for chlamydia treatment on the back, driven away from Colchester town centre as the gulls descended to the pavements for breakfast on really God only knows what that was left behind by the by the revellers.
Again, I think we make this a lifestyle choice available to people and then stand around slack-jawed and wide-eyed when they accept it. I think a lot of problems, social problems that crop up stem from that, is that we create the monster and then stand around in utter dismay when it runs amok. And I think, I think if there was a common thread between the two programs, it was that, is that we've facilitated this kind of behavior, the behavior in coppers and the behavior in party paramedics. We've facilitated it, we've allowed it, we've tolerated it, we've encouraged it. And now we're standing around scratching our heads that it's all terrible and out of control. It's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle now.
A quick couple of numbers to round our review of party medics and binge drinking up. A report in 2009 said that binge drinking cost the UK approximately £20 billion a year.
Yeah.
17 million working days are estimated to be lost due to hangovers and drink-related illnesses each year. That is extraordinary itself. And the cost of thus binge drinking to employers is estimated to be 6.4 billion per year.
Yes.
And it, and the, by the way, the cost to the National Health Service of alcohol harm, $2.7 billion per year in the UK. And that is just extraordinary. It really, really is.
It is, and there is no real strategy to reduce this. You know, there are strategies to stand by at the other end when people present with addiction problems and or, you know, cirrhosis of the liver, but there is no policy or strategy at the front end to try and convert the population away from this as a leisure activity of choice. It's you know, it is made available and people avail themselves of it, and there's no attempt for that to be made different, even if it could.
Well, going from one extreme of behaviour in society to another, I thought we'd just have a very quick look before you close us, because we're as ever, over time. I thought we'd have just a quick look at, I suppose we would call it dress codes, because of an incident that happened at Ascot Racecourse last Saturday, not long after we'd recorded last week's podcast, because it wasn't the royal meeting, of course. This was just a normal Ascot Racecourse meeting.
You didn't forget to put your spats on, did you?
What they did was they introduced, they did warn people, but they introduced a more stringent, more rigid dress code for the premier enclosure at Ascot. So they put it bluntly, the poshest enclosure area at Ascot last Saturday. Mm-hmm. Now, what started out as they clearly thought would be a sensible matter, instead, for people, it essentially, men had to turn up with a jacket and tie. Mm. That was the dress code. If men turned up without, particularly the tie, mm-hmm. what they thought was, well, look, instead of refusing them entry, we'll just have a quiet word with them and say to them, look, we are, you know, bringing in this policy, a quite more stringent policy. Mm-hmm. So therefore, next time, please do wear a tie. Mm-hmm. But this is where the wheels fell off, because they thought, well, in order for them, people only be told once and not to have stewards coming up to them every 5 minutes and saying, by the way, you know, tie, they put a little orange sticker on people's outer clothing so that stewards would know that this person had already been spoken to and been reminded of their dress policy. But, of course, nobody then took the simple step forward in terms of public relations and thinking that of the stigma of some steward, somebody you know, just paid to administer the to-ing and fro-ing in Ascot, coming up and plunging an orange sticker on your you know, tweed jacket.
Yeah, as much as to say, been told.
Exactly, yes. It's like, you know, having your forehead stamped or something. Yeah. You know, unclean. You know, as you say, you've been told. Yeah. And a racegoer described the process as being tangoed by the orange sticker brigade. Of course, there was absolute uproar, and it included, again, you would have thought that somebody somewhere in the racecourse hierarchy would have said, now let's think this through, because they also did it to journalists who were walking through the premier enclosure. So, of course, Twitter went mad, and all the newspapers all over the weekend, all the racing correspondents, you know, talking about their experience getting their orange stickers.
I mean, what I would say is that if had it been a race course, so let's say Dawes, particularly Doncaster, that would be a good choice. The sticker would have said bin, B-I-N, telt, T-E-L-T. It would have said
it's been telt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really love it when ill-thought-out plans go awry. I always find it really amusing, you know.
Yeah.
comes under the header, what were they thinking of? I would have thought it would have made considerably more sense to have gone to a Primark or a Peacock's or some such outlet and just bought, you know, several thousand plain black ties, had them in a big box, and everybody who came to the gate without a tie said, could you put this on and bring your own next time, please? You know, I've never happened to me, but I love that sort of stereotypical image of arriving at a posh restaurant and the maitre d' taking you to one side and giving you a tie to wear. I'd love that to happen to me. I think it's great. So maybe they should have gone down that route.
Maybe they should.
But shining a laser beam on your paying public and saying, you know, recidivist, you know, you may as well have had some kind of mobile banner or bib that attached to the person saying, he's let us down, he's let you down, and most of all,
he's let himself down.
Yeah, yeah. But I love it when ill thought through plans are put into are executed and,
absolutely.
And go horribly.
There were a thousand visitors to this premier enclosure last Saturday, and because of the uproar, the racecourse is actually refunding them their £28 tickets. So absolute PR and financial disaster. Exactly. But here's an odd thing, Magnus. In this new code for this premier admission, right? As I said earlier, it said gentlemen should wear a jacket and tie, smart trousers, or smart jeans. Smart jeans. Yeah. Now, how are they going to decide what is smart jeans? You could wear a jacket and a tie, so you could actually go in with a Paul Smith £500 jacket, a silk tie from Savile Row, and then jeans, smart or otherwise, are always going to be jeans, aren't they? Even if you've paid £200 for some of the latest, trendiest jeans. Yeah. They're still jeans.
Yeah, well, you can pay £300 for a pair of jeans by, Seven for All Mankind. That's an expensive jeans brand with holes already made in the jeans. £300.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I'll just compare and contrast this smart attire or dress code regime which is in place at Ascot with another organisation which is imposing a dress code on its clients this week. They've just launched the scheme and it is at the Social Security office in Dublin. And they have introduced, as of this week just gone, a no claimants in pyjamas ruling.
Oh, God. You're kidding me. You're saying that people came in to sign on wearing their gym jams.
Well, yes, not only that, but in a in sufficient numbers for a policy to have to be drawn up. Yes.
Oh, my goody arms.
We will not accept you for a claimant interview if you're in nightwear.
I did go speechless there for a second. I mean, I was going to, you know, if we'd have had more time, maybe we can come back to this another time and sort of explore the whole purpose and sense of a dress code. But I do think if I was working in the employment office in Dublin, I would rather be perturbed by someone coming in wearing, a floating nightie.
Well, yeah, so the reason...
Or a onesie.
The reasons the staff took action was that people were attending in their nightwear without sufficient undergarments. In more cases than a few, they were sitting interviewing somebody whose undercarriage was spilling out of their jar buttons. So.
Oh my God.
So there's a dress code that I think we can all sign up to.
Well, I think we're way over time, so I think it's a subject we could return to because I'm sure there would be no greater expert for the etiquette of what to wear at which social occasion than your good self.
Oh, I'm sure that's absolutely the case, yes. The last time we had lunch, I do recall you said to me, you do have a suit, don't you?
I did say that, didn't I?
Yeah. Patronising southerner meets gruff northerner over lunch in London.
Dear, yes, I do recall
London's
saying that.
Glittering Paddington. Yes, you do recall saying that. Yes, that will do. I haven't forgotten that, sir.
No, clearly.
Revenge will be mine. For the record, I have 5 suits. Thank you very much for your time and attention this week. Go and be posh somewhere and come back in 7 days.
And okay, see you later.
Thank you very much to you at home for listening, wherever it is that you listen to the podcast. We do appreciate your attention and your dedication to our meagre efforts. And we will be back in 7 days. In the meantime, that's it from the Parish Council. Bye-bye. Police and thieves in the street.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore Media Production.